It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin schools got their annual report cards this week. We'll talk about what they tell us about the pandemic's impact on learning in districts around the state. First, back in July of 2010, you could buy Bitcoin for 0.08 of a penny. If you bought $100 worth, you'd have about 125,000 Bitcoin. According to the website Motley Fool, that investment would have been worth $7.9 billion earlier this week. Not a bad 11-year return on investment. How in the world does something like that happen? Also, what is Bitcoin? The short, simple answer, it's a digital currency, also known as a cryptocurrency. So what does that mean? How about blockchain, non-fungible tokens? Like it or not, crypto is pushing deeper into the American mainstream. Just yesterday, the owner of the Staples Center in Los Angeles announced the venue will be renamed Crypto.com Arena. Axios says the 20-year deal is worth more than $700 billion. We're going to pick it all apart and hopefully get a better understanding of what's going on here. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about cryptocurrencies? Are there weird terms you've heard about and don't know what they mean? Do you own any cryptocurrencies? Have you thought about buying them? Why did you get involved? Is this all too new and unfamiliar? You're going to stick with what you know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Vivian Fang is an associate professor and the Honeywell Professor in Accounting at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. She teaches a course on crypto. Vivian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the introduction.
We saw a survey come out from an industry group of people finding out that a lot of us don't know much about cryptocurrency. 98% of people lack an understanding of basic crypto concepts. So let's start at the very beginning with that in mind, Vivian. What do we mean when we say cryptocurrency?
Absolutely. Let me start with the basics. So cryptocurrencies are decentralized digital currencies that rely on cryptography for security. So I always say that there are three special things about cryptocurrencies. First, they're virtual, meaning that they have no physical forms. There are no bills and no coins for you to see. Second, all cryptocurrencies are secure through cryptography, meaning that encryption techniques are used to ensure that records of cryptocurrency transactions are not tampered with. Third, most cryptocurrencies are decentralized, meaning that there's no central issuing agency like the Federal Reserve Bank or central clearing agencies like banks or credit card companies behind cryptocurrencies. So they entirely rely on the distributed ledger technology, typically a blockchain technology to record transactions.
And blockchain is a word that's key to this and another kind of confusing one. Can you put that in radio host terms that I can understand?
Yeah, absolutely. What's a blockchain? A blockchain, in simple terms, is a multiple-party data sharing platform. So if you have a lot of transactions that involve multiple parties, blockchain could come in very handy. So new data can only be uploaded to the chain if the participating computers on the chain agree. Existing data cannot be edited or modified afterwards. In more technical terms, a blockchain is a distributed, append-only ledger of provably signed, sequentially linked, and secure transactions that are replicated across a network of computers. And updates are determined not by a human, a government, or any other central authority, but by a software-driven consensus. And this consensus in the Bitcoin version of blockchain is commonly referred to as mining, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. And what is mining? Mining is basically a bunch of computers raising their computing power, trying to solve a mathematical puzzle to find a missing piece.
The best known cryptocurrency is one you and I have both mentioned already, Bitcoin. How many others? How much has this exploded into other kinds of coin or whatever they're being called?
Yeah, absolutely. Bitcoin, introduced in 2009, was the first real cryptocurrency and remains to be the most popular one with the largest market cap. Well, today, I guess Bitcoin dipped below $60,000. So the market cap is just a bit over $1 trillion. And the second most popular cryptocurrency is Ether, which builds on the Ethereum blockchain. And Ethereum has the second largest market cap just behind Bitcoin, which is around $480 billion today. And there's this very interesting difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum. Now, Bitcoin was intended to be a currency from the get-go, but Ethereum was actually created to allow developers to build and publish smart contracts on the network, which is why it is often described as a programmable blockchain. And the Ether is actually the token used on this network to facilitate operations. And for this reason, Bitcoin tends to attract general investors, and Ethereum tends to attract investors who are more into technology. And like you said, right, there are many, many other alternative coins and tokens. As of today, I believe there are over 14,000 types of coins and tokens traded on various exchanges and platforms. And I obviously don't have time to comment on every single one of them. But let me just highlight a few interesting ones.
Go for it.
So first, there's Litecoin. The thing about Litecoin is that, as you can probably tell from its name, it confirms transactions much, much faster than Bitcoin. There is another popular coin these days, Solana, which positions itself as a better and faster version of Ethereum. So it is a close competitor of Ethereum. There is Mana, which is a token for Decentraland, a platform that allows its users to buy and sell virtual properties. It is a very interesting token, especially if you're into the whole concept of metaverse. There is this Binance coin, which is a utility token used on Binance, a crypto trading exchange. And of course, there are meme coins like Dogecoin, Shiba Inu, Squid, which are named after many animals that you can think of. The thing about these meme coins and tokens is that they are highly subject to pump and dump schemes, so you have to be careful with them.
We're talking to Vivian Fang from the University of Minnesota, looking at cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, Bitcoin, Ether, Dogecoin, and all the rest. And you could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you find it all confusing? You are very much not alone, according to surveys. Have you invested in one of these cryptocurrencies? Have you bought something with them? Do you accept one, maybe Bitcoin, where you work? Does your line of work require you to use these kind of tokens? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Vivian, when I think of currency, I think of, you know, dollars and cents. And one thing I can do with those is walk into a place and exchange them for goods and services, or I could do that sort of virtually with a credit card. How common is it for people to just be able to buy stuff with Bitcoin or other virtual currencies?
Well, just like how you spend fiat currencies like US dollars, you can spend cryptocurrencies at many online businesses now. Thanks to PayPal, many online businesses now take major cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum for payments. Last year, PayPal introduced checkout with crypto service, so you can easily spend cryptocurrencies online while PayPal is accepted. And if you like to buy and sell cryptocurrencies or trade them, there are many places that allow you to do that. You can transact cryptocurrencies through platforms like Robinhood, PayPal, Square, or Coinbase, or you can do it locally. I believe that there are crypto ATMs in almost every state now.
We got a Facebook comment from Pete who says, how and why are cryptocurrencies so volatile? What's their real value? So kind of two separate questions there, really. First of all, yeah, we see a lot of volatility in the values of a lot of these coins. Why is that?
Yes. So that is a very good question. It's also a very tough question to answer. For assets like stock, right, we can apply valuation techniques to get a sense of whether they're overpriced or underpriced, right? I teach some of these valuation techniques in my class. And for fiat currencies like US dollars, the Fed plays a big role in deciding its value. Unlike stock or fiat currencies, cryptocurrency values are mainly affected by supply, the market's demand and competing cryptocurrencies, which makes it very difficult to come up with a precise number. Now, on the one side of the argument, cryptocurrencies are of great value to people like libertarians or cypherpunks. Those are the folks who created cryptocurrencies in the first place, because they represent a truly decentralized currency that is free from government intervention. So you will always have people behind cryptocurrencies if they subscribe to the same philosophy or ideology. Cryptocurrencies are also of value because they can now serve as medium of exchange, and they're anti-inflationary by nature. For example, Bitcoin. Bitcoin is capped at 21 million, and you can't go over that. And of course, on the other side, most cryptocurrencies have no intrinsic value. This is because they do not generate cash flows, nor do they have stable value. And its price, you know, as you mentioned, can be all over the place. So I do believe for cryptocurrencies to move towards mainstream acceptance, a certain measure of price stability needs to be achieved.
We're talking about cryptocurrency, blockchain, and more, trying to make sense of it all with Vivian Fang, Associate Professor and Honeywell Professor in Accounting at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about digital currency? And love to hear from you if you have thought about investing or have bought Bitcoins or Ethers or Dogecoin or whatever other digital currency. Tell us why you did it, what you've done with it, if you're willing to share that story. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about cryptocurrencies, what they are, how they work, whether they're here to stay. Vivian Fang is with us, Associate Professor and Honeywell Professor in Accounting at the Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. She teaches a course on crypto. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions. Maybe your experiences with Bitcoin or other digital currencies. Do you have them? Do you use them? What do you think? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to speak to the history of Bitcoin specifically a little bit. So really, Bitcoin was born out of the bailout decisions from 2008. And that's basically why it was designed the way it was designed, for that deflationary nature of the currency.
Gotcha. John, thanks for the call. Vivian, I think the timing is right there. Was that part of the motivation for creating Bitcoin, worries about inflation, wanting to have it as an extra, I guess, hedge against inflation?
More than that, but he's, you know, partly right. And to understand how cryptocurrencies were created, we have to do a bit of time traveling. I have to go back to the 90s, and when some folks who label themselves as cypherpunks grew increasingly skeptical of central banks. And so they really wanted a decentralized currency that is free from government involvement and intervention. And the worry extends beyond inflation. They want a decentralized currency that is truly native to cyberspace and has nothing to do with the government. And of course, you know, that was just an idea in the 90s, and it was not until 2009 did Bitcoin, the first real cryptocurrency, became a reality.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. You've used that phrase, Vivian, free from government intervention a couple times. Is it necessarily going to stay that way? Our governments around the world, I should say, looking to tax or regulate or do things to intervene in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. Well, I can tell you that there's definitely more regulatory interest and more regulatory efforts in the crypto space over the past 2 years. In my view, regulations are not necessarily a bad thing for cryptocurrencies, because they are necessary to the stability and the mainstream acceptance of cryptocurrencies. And if we look at the big picture, though, the fact that the U.S. government is looking to collect an estimated total of $28 billion worth of crypto tax to fund the infrastructure bill is telling us that the crypto market is probably not going to go away anytime soon.
Let's go back to our callers now. Josh is with us in Madison. Josh, hi.
How you doing? I have kind of two questions. The first one, is there a difference between buying Ethereum and mining Ethereum? And second, is there a trusted source on how to get into it, like a specific YouTube channel, or is it just randomly looking for them?
Josh, thanks for that call. First of all, mining versus buying. In this case, you mentioned Ethereum. They are very different things, right?
Well, they are. You are doing different benefit cost analysis, and you're also comparing the investment to other alternatives. When it comes to investing, right, you just put your money in Ethereum and you are comparing this particular investment versus investing in stock or other type of cryptocurrencies. And if you're looking into mining cryptocurrencies, you are doing an entire different set of calculations. You have to figure out whether the Ethereum that you're able to mine can outweigh the energy cost that you have to pay. So it's a very different type of calculation that you have to do before you decide on either one.
And Josh is wondering about a source for finding out more about Bitcoin. I mean, I assume there's a lot out there on the internet of varying quality. I'm not looking for investment advice for our listeners here, but what kind of things would you suggest somebody do for due diligence before they get into this fairly complicated market?
Absolutely. Well, first, they can always come to the University of Minnesota and take a class with me. But joking aside, there are many books and YouTube videos that people can look up. I really like the, I really like the open course offered by Princeton on YouTube, but the course is a bit on the tech side. And for basics, I think the book on Mastering Bitcoin is a good start. And for crypto-related news, Cointelegraph and CoinDesk are also great websites.
Josh, thanks for the call. Good luck if you pursue that. We are talking about cryptocurrency with Vivian Fang from the University of Minnesota. We'll go now to Judith in Milwaukee. Judith, hi.
My question for Vivian and people who are advocating and supporters of Bitcoin and NFTs is, how do you square that with global warming? Okay, Bitcoin mining is a very energy-intensive activity. I mean, we read about it. The livability of neighborhoods that are around these huge data centers is also quite difficult. And to me, Bitcoin's NFT and environmentalism is a huge oxymoron.
Judith, thanks for the call. I've seen concerns, Vivian. A lot of energy goes into the production of these various cryptocurrencies, raising concerns about create climate change emissions. Is that a concern you've run into?
So let me start by saying that it is true that as we stand, mining still consumes a large amount of energy. At the same time, the industry is taking a lot of initiatives to switch to more energy-friendly, more environmental-friendly way of mining. For example, that Ethereum is moving from proof of work to proof of stake, which consumes less energy. And also the industry is investing in a lot of renewable energy efforts and projects. So, I mean, for this industry, energy consumption is a life-death kind of situation. So you can count on them investing in renewable energy, and hopefully that it will require less energy going forward.
Thanks for the call, Judith. I will go now to Todd in northern Wisconsin. Todd, hello.
Good afternoon. If I were interested in buying a cryptocurrency, let's say Bitcoin, and I guess from my understanding, I would have to use dollars to buy that. What would Bitcoin do with those dollars? If cryptocurrency is the currency of the future, how do you pay for it with the currency of the past?
Todd, thanks. What happens to my dollars when I use it to buy Bitcoin, Vivian?
Well, it really depends on where you buy Bitcoin, right? If you buy it from a Bitcoin on a Bitcoin exchange, crypto exchange or a crypto platform, it goes to the platform. And if you buy from any company, your dollar is going to go to the company or platform because they have to settle using fiat currencies. If you buy in some of the purely crypto trading platform like BISC, then you could go be converted into a different type of cryptocurrencies.
Thanks for the call, Todd. Just one quick experiment, Vivian. If I wanted to start a coin, Robcoin is taken, but Ferretcoin isn't. If I create Ferretcoin with somebody smarter than me who does the blockchain, how does that initial value get set? Do I just pick a number or what determines its value?
For the most part, yes. That kind of goes back to the first question, right? How do we decide on cryptocurrency value? You can pick a number, but it doesn't mean that you will get that number, right? You can initiate that chain. You can initiate a smart contract in Ethereum and the value could plummet because the market doesn't buy the value that you set.
Interesting. Vivian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Vivian Fang, Associate Professor and Honeywell Professor in Accounting at Carlson School of Management at the University of Minnesota. Talk to her today about cryptocurrencies, what they are, how they work, and what the future may have in store for them. Still time for you to share your thoughts on cryptocurrency, maybe your personal experience if you've dabbled in it on one side or another. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Ferretcoin does not exist yet. Coming up after the news, an education expert joins the show for a closer look at how schools and kids' learning have been affected by the pandemic and a new set of report cards out from the state looking at schools around Wisconsin. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, many poor countries have struggled to get access to COVID-19 vaccines and medications to treat the virus. We'll find out why and some of the latest efforts to change that. Now, the State Department of Public Instruction has released its first assessment of Wisconsin schools since before the pandemic. The DPI report cards released earlier this week show that although test scores have declined since before the pandemic, 95% of school districts in the state met or exceeded expectations. But the DPI changed its metrics and goals for schools in order to adjust for the wide-reaching effects the pandemic has had on schools. We're talking about the state of Wisconsin schools, how the pandemic continues to affect them, and how to measure the impact of the pandemic on schools and how much kids are learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a kid in Wisconsin schools? If so, how did the pandemic impact their learning? Have you noticed learning gaps? Maybe they kept up even through remote learning. If you're a parent, a teacher, a student yourself, what has the return to normal, quote unquote, been like for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Alan Borsak is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Always glad to be here.
All right. There's this report card, and there's a lot of yeah buts as you look at it. Big picture, Alan, as you look at this thing, I mean, can we glean useful information about what happened to learning during the pandemic from it?
Yeah, but that's a good way of summarizing things. Yeah, there's useful information in there, but you don't need me to tell you that last year was really abnormal, and this year ain't so normal either. So that has to be considered in any assessment of how kids are doing, whether it's enrollment, whether it's test scores, whether it's, in this case, report cards, which are supposed to bring together a lot of data about schools, both district by district and individually. So they're all, just this enormous asterisk. That said, yeah, you can see a picture emerging here, and it's not too surprisingly, it's got a lot of reason to be concerned. Almost everything was down last year, especially at schools that were not in person for large hunks, if not all of the year. You know, that's not, frankly, I'm not going to take a stand on whether that was a good idea or not compared to COVID. Mm. But there's no question there was an educational price paid overall, and you can see it in the data here.
What kind of things do you see in the data that show that cost? I mean, I think there's a general consensus that there is a hit, but is it a blip? Is it something long-term? As you look at the data in this report card, recent test scores, what kind of things worry you from what you're seeing?
Well, enrollment statewide is a serious issue. There were a large number of children, young children, 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds, kindergarten and first grade, that were not in school last year, and a lot of schools were expecting them to come back this year, that the parents maybe kept them home as a precaution and out of fear last year. In the case of, say, a district like Milwaukee, which is still the big kid on the block when it comes to school districts in Wisconsin, there was some return, but not what was expected. Statewide, there was a slight decline in enrollment. In some places, there was substantial decline in enrollment this year. Ultimately, that speaks to a changing population in the state, but also changing interest in what parents are looking for in schools, or maybe increases in private schools and at-home education. It's a little too early to get all the data on that. But, there's change going on. And when it comes to academics, statewide and in many of the districts serving the highest need kids in Wisconsin, the picture was not pretty. A very large number of kids didn't take tests last year. I mean, if the state DPI had its way, it would have dropped all the tests and the report cards, but the federal government wouldn't allow that, and state law didn't allow that. And scores were down. Reading scores were really pretty terrible. Math scores were not so great. Everything had down arrows last year, and even if there's an understandable reason for that, it has to be regarded as very concerning.
Republicans in the state legislature are looking for a new reading assessment, a new test for kids with that reading gap, that reading loss in mind. What do you think of that idea and the best way to do it if we do that?
Well, their proposal was to screen kids, give tests to kids at the early grades through second grade, and identify them and give them more attention. A lot of this has to do with the legacy and the continuing nature of the so-called reading wars between whole language people and phonics people. It's a case where everybody's right and everybody's wrong in my book. Everybody's right in that there were flaws in the Republican idea, and there are certainly flaws in not doing anything. And everybody's wrong, and I sigh, obviously, that this seems – reading just seems to be like something – can't we all come together over reading? It's so obvious that something needs to be done. Reading scores are not good statewide. They're especially not good among populations of low-income kids and minority kids, Milwaukee, Beloit, Madison, Green Bay, you name it. I mean, in Milwaukee for many, many years, only about 20% of kids in both private and public schools were reading at a proficient or advanced level, and it just hasn't changed. They say, isn't this something we can come together around? And yet, in this highly polarized, highly partisan world, and especially within the Capitol in Madison, that just doesn't happen.
We're talking about the state of education in Wisconsin post-pandemic. Alan Borsak is with us. He is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your family, in your school, in your local district? Do you worry that a political divide is getting in the way of doing the best things for kids in schools and how they learn? What has 2021 looked like in your school so far? Whether you're a student, a teacher, a parent, what are you seeing? Is there a lot of learning loss, do you think? Are you bouncing back? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Alan, is there something with a proven track record that if people did come together, say in the Milwaukee district, when it comes to reading, do we know what would work?
Again, we get back to the reading wars. In my book, what really works is obviously really good teaching, and sometimes that can be from a whole different set of approaches. It can be an array of approaches, but really strengthening teaching of reading and the qualifications for teachers and supporting them with mentoring and such is not going on very much and would really help. As far as specific approaches, you've got very strong advocates for what they would call the science of reading, which would be more oriented towards phonics and fundamental approaches. The state, what I would call reading establishment, which would include the organization called the Wisconsin State Reading Association, which is the reading teachers group, and a lot of the unions and the State School Board Association, the DPI itself, are more into what used to be called a whole language, now is kind of been relabeled as balanced reading. I would feel better about what the establishment was doing if it was working, but there's just no change. So you say maybe it's time to listen to people who want to do things differently because what we're doing isn't going so well.
You mentioned the partisan divide over education. Obviously a big political football. We've had conversations on this show about, you know, the Virginia governor's race, critical race theory, political divides over masks. You and I have talked about the partisan divide in education over the years. Has it somehow managed to get even more divided than it already was?
Certainly seems that way. And you've got such heat. Not, you know, I think maybe it's been a little overstated about school board meetings where there's fist fights and that kind of thing. That's still fairly rare, but where there's big differences and really kind of a gridlock over doing things, that's seems to be becoming more common, whether it's over race issues, the so-called critical race theory, over COVID policies. I mean, masks and testing and such, vaccinations, people just are extreme in their views. I was at an event last week with leaders of a bunch of different schools in Milwaukee, different streams of schools. Almost every one of them said to me, this year is worse than last year as far as stress, as far as just keeping things going, because they're trying to keep the schools open. They're just exhausted. You've got a number of schools, I think a growing number, that are going to take all of Thanksgiving week off just because everyone's so exhausted, especially the teachers. So it's tough out there, and it's this stress and divisiveness that's enhancing that problem.
Talking to Alan Borsuk, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're looking at the latest news about schools in the state, their post-pandemic recovery, what's happening to test scores. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're connected with a school in any way, are you feeling that stress that Alan was just talking about? Is this a hard year for you, your student? If you're a teacher, a staff member at a school, are you feeling this? Is this year tougher than last year? If you have thoughts on the reading debate, phonics versus what Alan said used to be called whole language learning, love to hear from you as well. Do you have opinions on what it would take, thoughts on what it would take to make kids better readers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at student learning during the pandemic. New data on Wisconsin K-12 students came out this week. Education columnist Alan Borsuk stays with us, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your school, whether you're a student, a teacher, a parent, on the staff? What are things like in your community? Is this a rough school year, rougher than even last year, according to some? As Alan said, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Kay is with us in Appleton. Kay, hello.
Hi. I'm an educator here in Appleton, and I know you're talking about the recovery to get our reading scores back up, but a lot of Wisconsin, as well as some of the socially economic, like, lower schools that we have, we're still not at a point that we can recover. We're still helping our kids with, like, their family members that might not be able to work with a whole bunch of things. We have kids that are homeless because of the pandemic and everything. So I know that you're talking about the recovery of everything, but what are we doing to make sure that we can still help support so that way we can eventually get to the recovery? Because a lot of our families that these kids are coming from are still in crisis.
Kay, if I could ask, it sounds like there's a lot of work there before you could even get to what we think of as education, right? You're trying to meet some needs before you could even start learning again.
Yeah, like, we really just have to be there for the kids. And so, like, what if you're saying that we're trying to get our reading scores back up already, what type of programs are going to help make sure that we can help support our families that are extra stressed still, and then also going to make sure that we can work on those things? Because we do that. We have so many facets of our job. I just don't see how we're supposed to be continuing already to help. We're just trying to get them to sustain, to try to get to their regular grade level reading, and it's still really tough right now.
Okay, thanks so much for sharing that. Alan, I'm guessing Kay's not alone in schools around the state saying, hey, we're just trying to catch up with the damage from last year, much less, you know, get back on track with learning.
I think what she's saying is really important, and I'm sure she's speaking for lots of teachers in lots of parts of the state. And it's important, but it's also sad because, I think COVID and COVID policy and fights over COVID policy and just the needs of kids and families have almost pushed aside normal learning in so many situations, or at least damped it down. And the reason I say it's sad is that I don't have a better solution. I mean, people's needs need to be addressed. Health comes first. At the same time, you say, hey, you know, you're only in third grade once. You're only in 10th grade once. And the loss that's going on, ultimately, there'll be a price to be paid for this in terms of people thriving educationally. I mean, I take it very seriously that successful schooling opens the doors to all sorts of things beyond schooling years. And I worry that we're just not going to have that door so wide open because we're paying such a price now.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Alan, we had a caller call in with a little correction for me. I think I used a phrase like post-pandemic or after the pandemic.
Yeah.
We're still in a pandemic here. How, and schools are still worried about, you know, health and masking and outbreaks, and we've had outbreaks in schools in the state and elsewhere. I mean, how much is this still existing pandemic weighing on what we can actually accomplish in classrooms?
Well, there's no one answer, and a lot of it, frankly, correlates with the political orientations of communities, that red Wisconsin is handling things differently than blue Wisconsin, masking policies and so on. The Marquette Law School poll, which just came out today, and that's one of the things I work on at the law school, found that nationwide, worrying about the pandemic is down among all groups compared to a year ago, but it's still pretty high. And it tends to be down much more sharply among Republicans than among Democrats. So it's still a big worry. I think if you look in the Milwaukee area, the blue communities are mostly still using masks in school and being pretty strict about it. And that's not only the public schools, but most of the private schools. And the red communities, the suburbs that are in the outer ring, Waukesha, Ozaukee County, and so on, are mostly not masking. Who's right? Man, I'm not going to answer that question. but it is taking a toll. So it's still tough. And in both cases, I'm sure, for the school leaders and for teachers, like the caller from Appleton, just keeping things going, keeping kids on track, dealing with the issues that people are bringing into the school building, both adults and kids, man, it is so difficult. It is so stressful.
Thanks for that comment at 800-642-1234. Talking to education columnist Alan Borsuk about the state of Wisconsin schools. year and a half into the pandemic, seeing some declines in test scores, school report cards. Still time for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Alan, though, I did want to ask about a piece you wrote a couple few weeks back. You went looking for some bright spots in the Milwaukee area, and you wish there were more, but can you highlight a couple of things you found that that gave you some optimism?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I was about to write based on the test scores that had come out statewide and for Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area. I was about to write what I thought would probably be the most depressing column I'd ever written because they were bad. And it happened to be the day that the Hmong American Peace Academy, which is almost 2,000 students and almost all of them are from Hmong ethnic backgrounds, really special school that's just boomed in the last 15 years, was dedicating a new high school wing, $30 million wing. It's beautiful. And so I went there saying, I got to say something positive. And then I named a number of other schools. And they do exist. And they exist in all three streams of schools in Milwaukee, the public school system, the private schools, and the charter schools have a disproportionate number of them. They tend to be schools that are very ambitious about what their kids are going to achieve. They tend to be very cheerful places. People think they must be really strict, hard-nosed places. Hardworking, dedicated staffs, very stable in their student enrollment. They don't have as much turnover as a lot of schools. And the school culture, just the atmosphere in the place, which is actually a huge ingredient of a school's success, is so positive. So there are a lot of schools, even before the pandemic, this is a long-time problem, where their goal seems to be just, let's get through the day. And then there are other schools where they say, we're really out to do great stuff. And you can see the difference in the two. So, yeah, I could name 15 schools off the top of my head in Milwaukee that I'd say, these are really good schools. Unfortunately, there's way more than 15 schools in Milwaukee.
Let's go back to our callers now. Katie is with us in Sheboygan. Katie, hello.
Hi. I'm a teacher. I teach not in Sheboygan, but close by. And I have a student whose parent just died last week from COVID, and her other parent is in the hospital with COVID. So, you know, one of the things that a lot of students are dealing with here is the emotional toll that it's taking. And the idea that they could continue learning through this is kind of crazy.
Katie, thanks for that call. Alan, we've had conversations on the show about the availability of mental health care for students pre-pandemic. A bigger issue, as Katie points out, is students dealing with grief and fear and confusion during the pandemic. Do you see that as a big part of the story?
Well, yes. And the situation she's talking about is obviously really, really sad and dramatic. But even a more routine situation of just the stresses of being at home all last year and being away from your friends and worrying about the future, the whole social emotional toll on kids is getting much attention nationwide. It's one of the few things that there was some agreement between Republicans and Democrats in the state budget to increase funding for social emotional services to kids and social workers and school psychologists and general services. So there's a lot of attention to this, but the need way outstrips what's available. That's pretty clear. So, it's a huge issue.
Katie, thanks a lot for that call. And our last, just under a minute or so, Alan, what do you have your eye on next to see how schools are recovering here?
If they can stay open, as we know, the numbers are high and rising in Wisconsin. So if schools in large numbers have to close, and just if there's gauges of how much can the needle be moved, and it's not easy, back towards focusing on education and not just keeping some stability in lives that are so unstable. So my hope would be things will ease. Was that really going to happen? I don't know. But we'll pay a big price on a certain level if we don't educate kids, and that's an enterprise that's very difficult at the moment.
Alan, thanks again for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Alan Borsak is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Joined us today for a look at the latest data on K through 12 student performance in Wisconsin and how schools are trying to recover after a year and a half of pandemic. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a lot of church congregations around the country are being split by political divisions. Join Kate Archer-Kent and her guests for a look at partisanship in the pews. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Turn around, bright eyes, because tonight, technically early Friday morning, you can see something special in the sky. Not a total eclipse of the heart, but a partial eclipse of the moon. It's a lunar eclipse when the moon passes into the Earth's shadow. It's going to be the longest partial lunar eclipse event in 580 years, according to space.com. The moon will look weird. And here's some good news from producer Bill Martins, Central Time's weather nerd. Can I call him weather nerd? Let's just say weather fan. Most of Wisconsin should get a good look at the eclipse, just partly cloudy skies on tap for most of the state. Here in Wisconsin, you can start watching the eclipse a little after 1 a.m. No special eye protection needed, but Bill says bundle up warm. Going to be cold around the state tonight. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.